Dr. Kendra Stewart. He's going to speak to us about citizen-driven, not dollar-driven, government engaging young people. She's a professor, an advocate, and a public servant. Dr. Stewart is professor of political science and public administration and director of the Riley Center for Livable Communities at the College of Charleston. Her research interests include nonprofit management, state and local government, food policy, and women in politics. She's co-editor of a book entitled The Practice of Government Public Relations. Dr. Stewart is a fellow of the National Academy of Public Administration, NAPA, an independent, nonprofit, and nonpartisan organization chartered by Congress to assist government leaders in building more effective, efficient, accountable, and transparent organizations. She was also elected to serve as president of the American Society for Public Administration, ASPA, for 2020-21. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Margolese. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I was going to see if Benjamin would allow me to share my screen before I get started. I don't know if I have that ability. I think he just has to give me that opportunity.
Okay.
Just a handful of slides I'm going to share during the presentation. Yep. Now I see. Thank you very much. Great. Okay. And I will do that in just a moment. I really appreciate the chance to be here today. And as well as the theme of this conference, sorry, let me pull this up. There we go. Can you see that?
Yes.
Excellent. Okay. At a time when there is so much cynicism in our country, especially towards government, I greatly appreciate the optimism towards the future of America that this conference offers. I am honored and humbled to be among so many great thought leaders, particularly my two co-panelists, Dr. Perry and Ms. Haniff, who already shared such wonderful thoughts and ideas and are an awful, awful hard acts to follow for me. But I look forward to hearing more ideas from folks from throughout the week and the rest of the conference about how the core values of our country can continue to drive us in a direction of capitalizing on the tremendous potential that we have as a nation. I began my career working in state government and really enjoyed the ability to help create and implement policies that could make a real difference in people's lives. They weren't always exciting or glamorous policies, working on sewer systems or stormwater management, but they were important services that had a direct impact on our communities and their residents. When I left government to become a professor, I began to understand how little the majority of our people knew about government. These two experiences have created in me a passion for civic education and civic engagement, the two things that must exist in order for us to have a government based on popular sovereignty, one of our core values. In other words, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Today, I'll be discussing two things that I think impact civic engagement and are absolutely necessary in envisioning a better America. Getting a handle on the continually increasing influx of private money in politics and the importance of involving young people in our decision-making. To set the stage, I would like to share a little bit of data on how Americans feel. For approximately a decade, I worked on several nonpartisan public opinion polls studying voter attitudes and beliefs. I assisted with focus groups around the country to try to more deeply understand how people feel about our current state, our future, and our leadership. Based on everything I learned, I have a few general observations to share that will lay the groundwork for what my later thoughts on what we need to do to more positively realign to match our fundamental values. First, since 2001, voters have become more and more cynical about and distrustful of our government. According to Pew Research Center, right now, public trust in government remains very low. Only about one quarter of Americans say they can trust the government in Washington to do what is right just about always or most of the time. As you can see, this is something Pew has tracked since the late 1950s. And although it has gone up and down over time, we've been consistently low since the early 2000s. A second data point that is often referenced to describe the state of the country is what is referred to as the right direction, wrong track question. As you can see on this slide, that over time, people have less faith in the direction we are heading. Although opinion has gone back and forth over time, since 2003, more Americans believe we are headed down the wrong track as a country than believe we are on the right track. Related to this is a Gallup poll question measuring people's satisfaction with the direction in which we are heading. As of August of this year, only 23% of Americans are satisfied with the way things are going in the U.S. Although there has been a lot of evidence, particularly in the last two presidential elections, that polling is not always accurate, I would argue that after conducting dozens of focus groups throughout the country, that these polls do capture the feelings of most Americans. I base this on over a dozen national public opinion polls I worked on over the span of a decade. So the question begs, why? Why are people so dissatisfied, distrustful, and doubtful about our future? Based on the research I've worked on, I would say that concern over corruption and unethical behavior in government is the top reason. Respondents to some of the polls I've worked on consistently selected government ethics and corruption as the most important issue facing America. I do need to caveat this with the point that this 10-year research project concluded in 2019, before the majority of Americans became much more aware of and concerned about issues of social injustice and public health. In the focus groups we conducted following these polls, the same concern of government corruption was expressed over and over again. And the most consistent connection to corruption was private money. The average American citizen feels like their opinion does not matter to elected officials in the same way that the opinion of big donors matters. In fact, when asked, 85% of people agreed with the statement that there are different rules for the well-connected people with money compared to only 15% believing everyone plays by the same rules. Another very disconcerting response we consistently heard was the belief that we are not a country in which our government operates with the consent of the people. We tested this on a poll and found that less than one third of Americans agreed with the statement that the federal government has the consent of the people, a fundamental value that stems from our most important and heralded founding documents, the Declaration of Independence. So why? Public opinion consistently demonstrates dismay and dissatisfaction with the ever-growing dependence on political campaigns on private donations and the perceived influence that comes with campaign donations. Each election cycle, the amount of money raised and the amount spent continues to increase. According to Open Secrets, in 2020, over $14.4 billion was spent on the presidential and congressional elections, making it the most expensive election by far in U.S. history, and significantly more expensive than past elections. 9 of the 10 most expensive Senate races and 5 of the 10 most expensive House races also occurred in 2020. The largest category of donations is made up of large donors, defined as those who give over $200. This may not sound like a lot of money, but to most Americans, this amount is just not feasible. Overall, less than 2% of Americans give this much. A large percent of funds in this category come from a small number of very large donors. In fact, the top 100 donors gave $1.6 billion to political committees in 2020, accounting for 9% of the total fundraising. That is 100 donors giving over $1.6 billion. There is some good news, though, with the 2020 election. As can be seen here when looking at comparisons to 2016. First, you will note that there was an increase in the percent raised from small donors. going from 15 to 23%. This increase represents a growing number of donors who have traditionally not given to campaigns, particularly women, who accounted for 45% of donations in 2020, compared to 37% and 30% in 2016 and 2012, respectively. This type of grassroots fundraising was especially evident in the Trump campaign and in Democratic Senate campaigns, an interesting contrast if you think about it. This trend represents greater involvement by average citizens in the political process. Also on the upside, we see a decrease from 9 to 4% in the contributions by political action committees, or PACs. PACs have traditionally been used by businesses and organizations to gain access to elected officials and exert influence on elections. But with the growth of super PACs and the ability of wealthy individuals to give more, PACs seem to have become less important. On the downside, outside funding by super PACs and hybrid PACs nearly doubled from 2016 to almost $3.3 billion in 2020. These super PACs are often funded by what is known as dark money from undisclosed donors and take advantage of various loopholes in our system. They are believed to have tremendous influence on elections, and although are supposed to operate with an arm's distance from candidates and their campaigns, these laws are rarely enforced, and when violated, are not generally enforced when violated. Super PACs exist in each party, and according to Open Secrets, are consistently finding new ways to inject secret money into our system. A 2018 Pew Research Center report found several indications of public concern over campaign spending. They concluded that there is, and I quote, widespread and bipartisan agreement that people who make large political donations should not have more political influence than others. But Americans largely don't see that as a description of our country today. As you can see in this slide, 77% of respondents believe that there should be limits on the amount of money individuals and groups can spend on campaigns, and 65% believe that new laws could be effective in controlling this. What research tells us and what I have observed is more Americans are becoming frustrated and cynical over the amount of money that is donated to political candidates and the uneven power it gives to wealthy individuals and corporations over average Americans. Although it is completely legal, this practice seems to undermine our fundamental core value of equality by advantaging elites. It also undermines the faith and trust people have in our political system. We need to fix this and to level the playing field and make American government once more a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Now I want to focus on youth engagement. Civic engagement entails a broad range of actions and behaviors that improve communities and address public problems. Civic engagement ranges from volunteering to donating to political campaigns to contacting elected official or policymakers and to voting. Some countries require young people to serve their country either through military service or some other type of public service. Young people bring many assets to civic life, and there is evidence that engagement at a young age creates more lifelong active citizens who contribute to their communities. Much of this country's social change has been led by young people. Even the major events of the past several years regarding climate change, social and environmental justice, LGBTQ rights, and battling systemic racism continues this tradition of youth activism in our country. According to research done by CIRCLE, a center at Tufts University, youth activism has an extraordinary potential to transform communities, and it carries important benefits to those who participate, especially for low-income youth, youth of color, and other young people who have been historically marginalized from civic life. However, overall, young people are the least likely to vote and the most distrusting of any age group in our government. According to Pew in 2018, only around one third of people ages 18 to 29 trust and have confidence in our elected officials and our business leaders. It is important to note that this trust has declined even more in the past few years since the study was conducted, particularly regarding policing. Just as significant is that distrust in most of these areas is lower in young people from marginalized and underrepresented groups in our society. Although young people are supposed to be questioning authority and developing their political beliefs and attitudes, this low level of trust is disheartening and must be changed. The good news is that the 2020 election saw an increase in young voter turnout by 11 points from 2016. Overall, half of people aged 18 to 29 years old showed up at the polls, a record for recent elections. New Jersey, Minnesota, and Colorado all had over 60% of this age group cast ballots, a very promising number. So why this greater interest? First, we know young people were more driven by two timely issues, the COVID-19 pandemic and systemic racism. Polling showed young voters ranking these two issues as their top areas of concern, driving them to the polls. Climate change ranked third, and the economy and jobs ranked fourth. A second answer that has been studied by researchers at Tufts Circle Center involves understanding the effects of state electoral policies. A number of states have put policies in place making registering to vote and voting easier and more accessible for all eligible voters. Some of these policies include automatic voter registration, online voter registration, same day or election day registration, early voting, no excuse absentee voting, pre-registration, and requirements for voter registration programming in high schools. The use of mail-in voting was also examined. The researchers at Tufts divided states into those with a majority of the electoral policies I just mentioned and those with few of these policies, and found that on average, states with more of these policies had higher youth turnout. States with four or more of these policies had a combined youth voter turnout of 53%, compared to 43% turnout from states with less than four policies. They found that it appeared that a number of policies complement each other to create a system and a culture of voting that is more conducive to youth participation, and the lack of them may have the opposite effect. On average, youth voter turnout was highest at 57% and had the largest increases over 2016 in states that automatically mailed ballots to voters. States with the most restrictive vote-by-mail laws, conversely, had the lowest youth turnout, on average only 42%. So policies that increase ease and access matter. Over the next few years, states will be weighing whether or not to keep some of the changes regarding mail-in voting that they made in 2020 or to eliminate them altogether. I hope that as they do so, lawmakers will consider the impact these policies had on young people's voter participation. Additionally, this past spring, the House passed H.R. 1 for the People Act to standardize some of the aforementioned election laws across the country and expand Americans' access to the ballot box while reducing the influence of big money in politics. However, this bill did not get the votes to make it out of the Senate. So what can we do? The most important question, and some of the things we are here to talk about throughout this week: how can we make a difference and impact change and create a vision for a better America? How can we encourage greater participation and civic engagement, particularly by our future generations? Dr. Perry already provided so many great recommendations that I concur with: listening to others, connecting your passions and interests to work together to build bridges, and learning from our past by telling stories of our past generations. And Ms. Hanif's point on developing relationships and friendships by getting to know others from different backgrounds can increase our understanding, empathy, trust, and engagement. I would like to add a few more recommendations based on my research and specific to youth engagement. First, we need more civic education in this country, which Dr. Perry also discussed in his response to Dr. Marley's question. Educating all young people about how government really works and how they can participate can help equalize our understanding of our system that is complex and appears out of reach to many. James Wilson, one of the writers of the U.S. Constitution, said, and I quote, "In every government which is not altogether despotical, the institution or education of youth is of some public consequence. In a Republican government, it is of the greatest." I'm referring to education beyond what we teach in our textbooks. We need an education that is accessible and honest. Both of my co-panelists referenced this in their remarks, the importance of teaching young people what it means to be a citizen and how important it is to participate in the process. All of great leaders who have come before us and have created major change in our country knew how important it was to have an educated public to make informed decisions when selecting our leaders, recommending policies, and just solving community problems. Our first president, George Washington, chose to highlight the importance of civic education in his farewell address by calling on us to, and I quote, "promote then as an object of primary importance, institutions for the general diffusion of knowledge. In proportion as the structure of a government gives force to public opinion, it is essential that public opinion should be enlightened. Second, provide meaningful opportunities for young people to engage in community decisions." And I mean something beyond showing up at public meetings to speak for 30 seconds about a policy for which votes have already been predetermined, or providing a 30-day online forum for public comments that will be considered. There are local governments around the country that are working hard at creating citizen committees to drive decisions. I have seen communities get meaningful citizen input on budgeting, planning, zoning, and even policing. For example, in the city of Charleston, where I live, a diverse, inclusive committee was put together to develop a climate action plan to address the great challenges we are facing due to sea level rising and increased flooding. After months of work, the plan passed unanimously through a very divided city council because of the diverse group of citizens who developed the plan and came to advocate for it. A group of business owners, high school students, scientists, and leaders from our African American and Hispanic communities. It is a plan that considers all neighborhoods and all people living in our community, with an emphasis on environmental justice and attempting to address some of the problems created by past unjust decisions. Some communities are doing better in civic engagement, but we need to continue to grow these opportunities for meaningful interaction and input. And we also need to be more intentional about involving young people in this engagement. Third, as previously mentioned, we need to continue to increase access to voting to all citizens. We have seen how these policies do work in increasing voter participation, particularly young and minority voter participation. And we need to act on having a government that encourages and values the votes of all Americans. And finally, we need to do more work to level the playing field by focusing more on government ethics with campaign finance reform. Young people don't participate because we often hear that they feel like their voice doesn't matter. It is our job to make sure that all of us feel like our voices matter and that no voices matter more than others. So with that, in closing, I just want to thank you for your time today and for listening to my vision for a better America.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stewart. Wonderful. I will lead off with a question very similar to what I asked Dr. Perry. When you present these important ideas to your students, what's your response? And I'm interested also in your understanding of what opens students to listen and to accept your ideas, and what keeps some of them closed off?
No, I think that is a great question. And like Dr. Perry, it's often somewhat of a mixed response. Teaching political science students or graduate students in public administration, there's always already a bit of a skew of students who have that passion. But I would say the most common recent reaction from students is we've really seen a movement of students away from wanting to work in public service. And unfortunately, I need to get Ms. Hanif in front of more of these students to tell her story. And so when they can hear and see, you know, the more diverse perspectives and the impact working in public service can have on people's lives, because younger people don't believe that our government can fix problems now. In fact, we're seeing a real migration, particularly in our graduate programs, of students more interested in working in the nonprofit sector, which is equally important and also plays a really important role in addressing community problems. But to me, it has demonstrated when we start talking to our students, and this is a national trend, not just in the students I encounter that we hear about from local government managers. And so in encountering this trend, we happen to have all these conversations about ways in which government can impact change and that government can listen and serve people in ways that we perhaps don't always realize. And so, you know, I do often get a mixed response, but the more they learn and the more they become knowledgeable about ways they can contribute, particularly at the local level, we tend to see a greater interest in students being engaged. And so whether it's we have students who volunteer on campaigns and get to know candidates, or students who attend local public meetings or serve on committees, we do seem to see a bit of an increase of optimism in those people.
Very good, very good. Now, on your point earlier that Hila Hanif would be good for your students to listen to, all these presentations will be live streamed, I mean, archived on the website. So you potentially could invite them or even assign them to listen to her presentation and, you know, write a little response, a little hand in a little essay about it.
I agree. And with Dr. Perry's conversation as well, I definitely plan to assign some folks to look at both of those. So thank you for pointing that out.
Yes, very good. Terrific. So when you encourage students to volunteer for local government activities, such as this wonderful Citizens Committee in Charleston, what percentage would you say take up that invitation?
You know, at the undergraduate level, it's not as high as it is at the graduate level. You know, and the undergraduate level, students are very interested in federal government more, I would say, because they see that as the most it's the form of government they've learned and studied and think of as being the most impactful. But, you know, once they realize that local government is the most accessible, I do tend to have a large number of them take us up on that opportunity. And again, particularly with graduate students who feel like their answer is working in nonprofit, because they're very, you know, this generation is very committed to service, but they don't think of it in the way maybe past generations have. Like I said, they don't think of it as much as being impactful through government service, but through nonprofit service. So, you know, once they realize or see what some of the things our local governments are doing and understand that it's those policies that have the greatest impact on our lives, they do become much more interested in it. But it is a process, and there's not enough of us encouraging that or telling, you know, I only teach a handful of students. We need more people out there making sure that there's a, you know, a